And welcome, 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 dear listeners. Yes, if you're wondering why does my why does Dwight's voice sound a little bit froggy? Well, yeah, guys, I've been caught offside by a very weird bout of flu. I don't know where it came from. Probably some colleague's air conditioner somewhere. But, you know, we won't place any particular blame anywhere else. It's just obviously, you know, you've got to look after yourself in that regard. But anyway, welcome you to this Sunday morning session of my Sunday morning take. The sounds particular that you just heard in terms of introducing or laying us the pathway into this morning session, coming through from the song Dime, feature obviously performed by Aaron Rodgers and Kanka Musa, and the song before that, The Weight of Love, from the Black Keys, ultimately starting us off on this Sunday morning session. Now, as we always do, dear listeners, we take a look at the very interesting discussions and the very interesting developments that have formed up, the interesting things that we have seen humanity has actually been part of, has developed, and has sometimes also created. For example, like our discussion for this morning. We step into the world specifically of the electric vehicle's particular pathway and its very first ideas that have been developed of it or have been portrayed of it. Specifically because the developments in the electric vehicle market has seen some major developments go through. From the adoption by the French President Emmanuel Macron for the very first electric vehicle that the French president or a French presidency has adopted or accepted, to particularly the September 2025 statistics that show that electric vehicles have actually spiked in sales in this year itself. Well, September being supposedly one such particular month that has outperformed itself vis-a-vis its same period of 2024. And primarily that it seems like this is going to be the continuation. This trend is just going to get stronger, continue to move on, and ultimately also expand itself. Now, this particular interesting development has shown itself to actually supplement the appetite for another kind of mode of transport besides the combustion engine discussion. Now, we find ourselves, dear listeners, in this particular interesting discussion, reason being that this is not the very first time, this specific era, that the electric engine or the electric vehicle, it would have been nice to have seen an electric engine, but that the electric vehicle actually has been the first idea that has come into existence. Now, just for us to set the scene primarily and just understand what's primarily going on in terms of some of the key developments that obviously kicked off. Now, back in May of this year, specifically, the French President Emmanuel Macron selected, and this is just after what they celebrate in the month of May, known as Armistice Day, the French President participated in a commemorative ceremony, and obviously he showed up in a presidential vehicle known as the Presidential DS number 8. Now, this was the first time he, as a head of state or head of state of France, decided to use an all-electric vehicle as an official vehicle. And the DS automobile, the model itself, was specifically developed by DS Automobile. DS Automobile obviously is a particular subdivision of one of the largest French producers. I know that it comes through from well, it's actually one French automobile manufacturer that owns it, besides, you know, the manufacturer, because DS is part of the Citroën brand. So the particular discussion obviously is that the president decided to roll up. Yes, we'll use that word, roll up, in the DS, in the DS number 8. And it was obviously equipped with a battery. This particular vehicle, had a range in terms of how far it could drive with that single charge of 750 kilometers. And obviously since it was a presidential vehicle, obviously it comes with all these other bells and whistles, and that it has its very interesting developments obviously associated to that particular model. But getting into the very interesting development that came up just in September, the latest round in terms of looking at global electric vehicle sales, is that global EV sales hit a record of 2.1 million in September for itself. Now, who was leading, or the top countries that were, the top companies, sorry, that were leading these particular trends, were predominantly Chinese and German companies. Why? Because the global sales of the fully electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles rose by 26% in September from a year ago to record a 2.1 million units being sold. Now, this was driven by the strong demand in China and a late US tax credit rush. This is as the market research firm Rho Motion had indicated back in October. Now, China accounted for about 2/3 of global sales, with about 1.3 million units being sold there, while North America also hit a record as buyers moved to secure incentives before they expired. Now, China is the world's biggest market and accounts for more than half of the global electric vehicle sales, which is Rho Motion's data, includes battery electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids. September, typically China's busiest month for car buying, saw sales rise as shoppers looked obviously to make most of trade-ins, subsidies, before some regions started phasing them out. The US demand reflected a surge as buyers rushed to claim the expiring $7,500 EV tax credit. So you get a tax credit if you buy an electric vehicle in the United States. That's pretty awesome. It's a pretty awesome kind of a subsidy coming through from the US government right there. Now, although demand in the US is expected to decline sharply in the fourth quarter, which is the 3 months ending in December, as both consumers and businesses lose access to the federal incentives that have underpinned the electric vehicle purchases. Now, looking primarily at some of the particular discussions and some of the particular developments obviously that took place, the four areas that have been scoped or have been mapped is China, Europe, North America, and the rest of the world. And as always, you know, looking at it, you always have China outperforming, you know, in demand in terms of most of the sales, followed by Europe, and then followed by North America, with the rest of the world following on after that, which accounts and adds up all of the 2.1 million. Now, this already should tell you, dear listeners, that there is major appetite and that there is major developments ongoing in the battery, well, let's call it the electric manufacturing component of these vehicles. Now, obviously, the history of the automobile, as it is known on the internet, well, even if you go and search up the history of the car, you'll still get to the same thing as well. But the history of the automobile dates back predominantly to a very early period. Many of us would jump as early as here at the, you know, start of the 20th century. No, you'd be wrong. Technically, it's way earlier, 1649 at least, where it was once again another German gentleman, this time known as Hans Hauch, from Nuremberg, who tried to build a clockwork-driven carriage. Yeah, if you don't know what a carriage is, today we call them donkey carts, you know, that situation there. But imagine it, you know, him trying something mechanical without the donkey in the front. Now, this obviously speaks towards the very, very first idea that came up for an independently powered device without any animal input or any animal energy being used, and primarily that it aimed to be steered by said particular user, the human, obviously directing it towards the particular destination or the functions it had to do. Now, as we obviously look at that particular scenario, because just after that, the first steam-powered vehicle was then created by another German, Ferdinand Verbiest, who then came a little bit later on. And that conversation, dear listeners, in its own right, can go on in its own particular development, but obviously we're looking at the electric vehicle discussion. So since we now know that the first particular ideas for the automobile actually started in back in the 1600s, you know, mid-1600s to be exact, the first idea for the electric car itself actually popped up only in the 1800s. The crude electric carriages that were invented in the late 1820s and the late 1830s were practical, commercially available electric vehicles that obviously, you know, only came a little bit later on in the 1890s. So in the 1820s, 1830s, people were still experimenting. They were trying to find a way of getting this particular carriage moving by itself. Yes, and they were making use of carriages. They were. If you don't know what a carriage was, if you've never seen what a carriage looks like I explained it just a few minutes back, imagine the donkey cart situation that we know here in Namibia, but just make it a little bit more fancier. Now, it is still known up until 1900, up and until 1900, just to let you know, that it was an electric vehicle that held the first vehicular land speed record until 1900. It was an electric vehicle that held a land speed record up until 1900. And also in the late 20th century, the high cost, low top speed, and low and short range of battery electric vehicles compared to the internal combustion engine vehicles led to a worldwide decline in their use as private motor vehicles. There you go. It primarily is also the same particular concern that already exists in Namibia, even though the very pragmatic discussion that popped up last year when, you know, I attended the particular sort of like electric vehicle day that was held at the city of Windhoek, and a very elderly gentleman, local businessman here in Namibia, cited and explained to us, the crowd, that there is PowerPoint, you know, that makes it sound like a Microsoft discussion. There are plug-in or, you know, recharge points everywhere in the city if you look at it. Yes, it makes sense. Very logical. Secondly, who will allow you to come and plug in and charge from your house if you don't know the person? And secondly, even if it's someone that you know, that person will probably also charge you because many people are also the, you know, what they call it, the guys that buy electric units in advance, meaning prepaid electricity. So that also makes it a slightly, you know, cumbersome, problematic scenario without the designated charging points being present. Another scenario is also primarily the range. How far can you drive with the thing? In many cases, many of the electric vehicles that I do know of, they have a range specifically of just below 400 or at the most 400 kilometers. And that's just it. That's that one battery charge. And then you've got to go charge it. Let's, for example, say you decide to drive all the way to Swakop from here. Now you've got to go charge where you are right there. Will you be allowed to charge there? Is there an indication of charging there? That's a very wet area at the coast as well. Why? Because there's a lot of mist. Are there designated charging points there? Do the charging points also come, you know, with waterproof facilities or some sort of a protection mechanism against the very wet conditions that persist at the coast? But obviously, you know, that's us just jumping a little bit ahead of time, or ahead of us in that specific indicator. The obvious particular developments that then obviously also took place after the particular adoption of the combustion engine has been that things just went quiet for a very long time. Now, electric vehicles have continued to be used for loading and for freight equipment and for public transport, especially in rail vehicles. At the beginning of the 21st century, the interest in electric and alternative fuel vehicles then started popping up. This increased due to growing concerns of the problems associated with hydrocarbon-fueled vehicles, the internal combustion engine, the thing we have right now. This included damage to the environment caused by their particular emissions, the sustainability of the current hydrocarbon-based transportation infrastructure, as well as also the improvements in the electric vehicle technology that have taken place. And that since 2010, combined sales of all electric vehicles and utility vans achieved at least 1 million units that were delivered globally in September of 2016. 4.8 million vehicles or electric vehicles in use at the end of 2019, and cumulative sales of light-duty plug-in electric cars that reached the 10 million unit milestone by the end of 2020, respectively. This actually showed the growing trend, the growing demand. Now, the global ratio between annual sales of battery electric cars and the plug-in hybrids went from 56 to 44, which is at least a 1.3 to 1, that's the ratio, in 2012, to a 74-26, which is a 2.8 to 1, in 2019. And it fell back to a 69-31, which is a 2.2 to 1, in 2020. The ratio just being, full battery electric and a plug-in hybrid. So they obviously highlight to you the differences between the two particular kinds of electric vehicles that exist. And just to explain to you what a plug-in hybrid looks like, guys, a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, they are known as a type of hybrid electric vehicle that is equipped with a rechargeable battery pack that can be directly replenished via charging cable plugged into an external electric power source. On top of this, they can also have a particular charging mechanism or charge that can take place to an external power source as well. But they also have an internal combustion engine. In many cases, you find this with a lot of the Japanese cars that also produce the particular hybrid engines. Specifically, you find Lexus. But Lexus's hybrid is predominantly the combustion engine charges the battery. So the internal combustion engine charges the battery in the car, not the battery gets charged in externally. In other scenarios, you also have Mitsubishi that recently brought out the Outlander, which also has a recharging ability itself. I don't know if the one in Southern Africa has that feature, because I have not seen them promote that in such a scenario in Southern Africa. As far as I know, there's a whole bunch of the Japanese cars in Southern Africa. They're not yet pushing any of their particular electric variants as yet. I'll be lying there, because I know Toyota is already pushing some of its electric variants, or hybrid variants for that matter. You will obviously see it with the blue, it's got a little blue outline in its badge, which usually indicates the electric or the hybrid component. So that means it's only them so far that I know of. The other guys, Honda does have one car. Honda does have one car. But all the Japanese guys use its combustion engine charging the battery. If they use hybrid, it's the internal combustion engine charging the battery. Meaning you can't plug in hybrid, plug in the battery and charge the battery separately. Still to be seen, still to be observed. We'll obviously see this space developing in future. Now, The particular dimension obviously has been that the plug-in hybrid electric vehicles obviously are predominantly passenger vehicles, and that they also they're also found in other variants of the everyday vehicle, in sports cars, commercial vehicles, vans, utility trucks, buses, trains, motorcycles, mopeds, military vehicles, and in boats. This is obviously in terms of how these particular developments have been ongoing, and that the plug-in variants can also be centralized generators of renewable energy primarily to be largely emission-free, or they might also make use of a fossil fuel plant, in which case they displace the greenhouse gas emissions from the car's tailpipe exhaust to a power station. So there's obviously very clever engineering and economics that was applied specifically to the development of that specific car itself, that obviously being the plug-in variant, or the plug-in hybrid variant. But the most important thing has been that this has just grown exponentially across the world. As of August, August 2020, the fully electric Tesla Model 3 was the world's all-time best-selling. Well, this particular resource is a bit out of date in that statement that it just made. However, because it's actually BYD that's in charge of all sales that have been, or the biggest sales that have been seen across the world. BYD still leading the sales in that regard. And this obviously highlights primarily that this is just growing. So, the earliest electric vehicle that actually began was found specifically by a Hungarian priest. A Hungarian priest specifically, he was also a physicist, Anyos Jedlik, in 1828, invented an early type of an electric vehicle. So you could think of it as a prototype, and created a small model powered by it. However, by 1832 and 1839, the Scottish inventor Robert Anderson developed a crude electric carriage. In 1835, a professor by the name of Sir Brandis Stratting of Groningen in the Netherlands and his assistant Christopher Becker from Germany created a small-scale electric car, which was powered by a non-rechargeable primary cells. Primary cells, just for that matter, dear listeners, was a kind of a battery that is designed to be used once and then it's discarded after that. So it was a single-use battery cell that was developed back then. This then followed on to the electric motor locomotives that came in. By that time, the locomotive itself was already in use. Why? Because the steam locomotive was already something that was one of the potential developments, obviously, that made things a little bit quicker in terms of the industrial developments that were taking place during the first industrial revolution. With the particular developments of the electric locomotives, in 1834, a blacksmith by the name of Thomas Davenport from Vermont in the US built a similar contraption which operated on a short circular electrified track. The first known electric locomotive was built in 1837, 3 years after Davenport, in Scotland, by a chemist, Robert Davidson, of Aberdeen. And it was also powered by galvanic cells, which were batteries. Now, Davidson later built a larger locomotive named Galvini, exhibited at the Royal Scottish Society of Arts exhibition in 1841. Now, you would be asking me, why did he exhibit it at a specific, exhibition scenario? An exhibition is almost like the expos that we know here, and the trade shows that happen here across Namibia. In many cases, primarily because to showcase the latest developments and the newest things. So what used to happen in the 1800s in Europe specifically, with the guise of the first industrial revolution was that they had all these particular shows where they would exhibit the latest developments taking place. Very interesting things. And then people would come across to, from across the world. Obviously, we have to understand that this was a particular period where it was not as, you know, as friendly-ish. But still, people would come from across the world, showcase various particular things, new ideas to be sold, new ideas to try and change, you know, certain particular developments in life and achieve certain particular, you know, improvements or, you know, just try to make their dreams happen specifically for themselves. And in many cases, many of these guys were first-time inventors or they were inventors of something. Or they were, you know, trying new things, trying to see if they can play a specific role in some or other particular development. And, you know, would literally be the first particular person to get lucky and actually get the necessary funding or sort of like, is it funding or is it bankrolling? Funding specifically to see their idea actually pop off. Just to let you know, guys, in terms of the same world of industry and development, and this is one of the most interesting things that I actually saw over the past 4 days specifically was that, was a particular resource that highlighted to me that there was in human history levels of ingenuity, to the level that I was surprised that it actually even existed. There was a rifle, and I'm sorry for mentioning, talking about, you know, a negative technology, which came about. But in many cases, much of these technologies were created specifically to be sold to the armies back then. So there was a rifle, dear listeners, which the Austro-Hungarian army was light years ahead in this technology specifically, by having this particular rifle. It was known as a Girardoni. The Girardoni air rifle was a rifle that did not run on, gunpowder. It did not use gunpowder for any matter. It was one of the first repeating rifles and was, designed and created by a watchmaker and a gunsmith, Bartolomeo Girardoni. Now, the particular rifle was made for a specific unit in the Austro-Hungarian army. And this particular rifle actually gave itself its name. The rifle's name, as mentioned, is the Girardoni, but it had a nickname known as the Windbush. Windbuchse. So this particular rifle didn't use any gunpowder. It was developed in 1795. It was a rifle specifically used by the, the frontier units of the army. If you think about it, frontier units back then were the guys that were defending the borders. It was for the first time used by the two American explorers, the Lewis and Clark expedition, where Lewis and Clark exhibited it to the local Indian tribesmen as they were crossing from the east coast of the United States to the west coast. By that stage, the U.S. wasn't fully the U.S. as we know it by today. And they showcased what this rifle could do. This rifle had, all it needed was to be charged with air, with a specific air capsule, and it could pop off at, it had a rapid fire feature, meaning you could shoot a lot faster. Highlighting that particular development, dear listeners, should obviously illustrate to us that the realm of development, the realm of imagination should not be limited. Should never be limited and should never be something that should be left up to the devices of someone else as well. If you can think about something, if you can see how one particular development had taken place let's say, 100 years ago, obviously that means that it's outside of its scope, primarily of patent or even of copyright or intellectual property protections. This obviously also brings us back to the electric vehicle discussion, primarily in that the exhibition, at least where Davidson showcased his large locomotive prototype named the Galvini in 1841, it was a 7,100-kilogram vehicle that had two direct drive reluctance motors. Drive or direct drive reluctance is a mechanism designed where the force from a prime mover, or this motor, is transmitted directly in terms into the rest of the mechanisms that make the item move. Now, it used electromagnets. So magnetism was also part of the discussion. Although there was wood, which was also a little bit of a downside. I mean, this is the 1840s. What do we expect, you know? Somewhere wood would still be a discussion. Plastic obviously only came way, way later. And plastic was used in many cases where it literally replaced wooden pieces in manufacturing and in product use. This particular, or the Galvini, could actually haul a load of at least 6,000 kilograms, which was 6 ton, for a distance, or at a distance of at least 6.4 kilometers, or at a speed, sorry, of 6.4 kilometers per hour, for a distance, or at a distance at least of 2.4 kilometers. So it actually just showed, you know, that it can use, it's a prototype, the thing can run, it can actually run for so long, this is how long the particular experiment could last. Now, it had limited power from the batteries that were that actually prevented its particular general use. It was also destroyed by railway workers afterwards, because obviously this was a prototype. So the poor guy, specifically Davidson, you know, just had this prototype to showcase at various expositions or at various exhibitions. The railway workers obviously saw this as a threat to their particular security of employment. Now, a patent for the use of the rails as conductors of electric current was granted in England in 1840, and similar patents were issued to Lilly and Colton in the US in 1847. The first battery rail car was then used in 1887 on the Royal Bavarian State Railways in Germany. So, highlighting the particular developers, obviously, that come through with electricity and with electric motors and the likes, these things were taking place way earlier. Way, way earlier. However, dear listeners, we quickly take a short musical break. After the musical break, we come back and we head into the rest of our discussion here on my Sunday Morning Take, here on your number one talk radio station.
Thank you. Thank you. 'Cause I can't take you. It's perfect, so it's done.
And we come back there from the sound specifically of the Future Islands people with Corner of My Eye. Before that, a little bit of Simply Red with the song A New Flame. And it brings us up to the halfway point of this morning's show of my Sunday Morning Take. Specifically, as you're in my company from 5 to 7, where we always dissect all these developments taking place. Specifically from everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between in terms of understanding some of the developments that obviously took place in these aspects. Now, the previous chapter that we just explored before the musical break was the chapter in terms of where the first particular developments were actually taking place. Like early history, you know, people experimenting with things, people, you know, finding out what they were doing. In our next chapter, we're actually looking at first commercial rollouts, first commercial adoptions, first full deployments of the said particular technology, specifically for the electric vehicle. And mind you guys, all of this is still within the 1800s. All of this is still within the 1800s. Now, rechargeable batteries, mind you, that provided obviously a viable means for storing the electricity on board a vehicle did not come into being until 1859 with the invention of the lead acid battery by the French physicist Gaston Plante. Now, Camille Alphonse Faure, another French scientist, significantly improved the design of the battery in 1881. His improvements actually greatly increased the capacity of such batteries and led directly to their manufacture on an industrial scale. Now, what is also likely, the first particular human-carrying electric vehicle with its own power source was tested along a Paris street in April of 1881 by the French inventor Gustave Trouvé. In 1880, Trouvé then improved the efficiency of a small electric motor developed by Siemens, yes, one of the particular German company, Siemens, from a design that was purchased from the Siemens guy, or actually by a gentleman by the name of Johann Kravogel in 1867, and used the recently developed rechargeable battery, fitted it to an English James Starley tricycle, and then so inventing the world's first electric vehicle. So he took a battery, took a tricycle, fitted the two of them together, and voila, Bob's your uncle. Bob's your uncle. Just like that. Now, although this was successfully tested on 19 April 1881 along the Rue Valois, in central Paris, the unfortunate thing is that Trouvé's particular ability to patent that what he tested literally was something he forgot to do, because he was unable to patent it. So Trouvé swiftly adapted his battery-powered motor to marine propulsion to make it easier to carry his marine conversion to and from his workshop to the nearby River Seine. Trouvé made it portable and removable from the boat, thus inventing the first outboard motor. And so, on 26 May of 1881, the 5-meter Trouvé boat prototype called Le Téléphone reached a speed of 3.6 kilometers per hour, going upstream and 9 kilometers per hour downstream. It then stepped over into another particular realm of further inventions that came about. An English inventor by the name of Thomas Parker, who was responsible for innovations such as the electrifying the London Underground, he also electrified overhead tramways in Liverpool and in Birmingham, and the smokeless fuel Colite, built his first electric car in Wolverhampton in 1884. Now, this is even though, although that the only documentation is actually a photograph that was only taken in 1895. Now, Parker's long-held interest in the construction of more fuel-efficient vehicles led him to experiment with an electric vehicle, or in the realm of electric vehicles per se, because he was also concerned with the malign effects that smoke and pollution were having in London. Because remember, this is the 1800s. Factories were popping up. At that stage, there was no thinking towards, you know, what impact these steam engines would have, or these steam factories would have specifically on the air quality, as well as also the overall health specifically of the inhabitants of London and these industrializing cities across Europe. So the particular concern was legit. Now, the production of the car was in the hands of the Ewell Parker Company, which was established in 1882 for the construction and sale of electric trams. Now, trams are no longer, manufactured, but they are maintained, primarily because of their easy to use and their cost effectiveness, you know, in terms of being surface level transportation mechanisms. But they're only used in a handful of cities around the world. Only in those cities. They don't make trams technically anymore, like new technologies of the thing, but they're only used in those cities. And remember, trams came about before the car. Trams came before the car. Trams were the first electric mass transportation mechanism that went full scale. If you don't know, most trams are electric. They follow an electric cable that pushes the device, which is the electric, which is the car, forward. They follow a specific circuit of tracks, and they are powered by overhead electric cables. That's what trams do. Trams are the first mass-produced, sort of like properly functioning, 150 years later technology. They still exist, but they are no longer being made, primarily because, you know, developments happened in between. Now, as obviously being responsible for making the electric trams, the company merged with other rivals in 1881. This is now the Ewell Parker Company that was making the trams, to form the Electric Construction Corporation. And this particular company had a virtual monopoly on the British electric car market in the 1890s. The company manufactured the first electric dog cart in 1896. The dog cart was a two-wheeled horse-drawn vehicle that was pulled by a single horse on shafts. So it was a thing about it. It's also our modern-day donkey cart, specifically. The French and the British were the first nations to support the widespread development of electric vehicles. The German engineer Andreas Flocken built the first real electric car, the Flocken Elektrowagen. It looked weird because it looked like a carriage of the time, but it had an electric motor with its own little steering device. It was pretty compact. Obviously didn't have a boot. Obviously didn't have a front nose situation. And it was rudimentary, meaning very basic in its design. And this was designed in 1888. Electric trains were also used to transport coal out of mines, as their motors did not use up precious oxygen. Before the preeminence of the internal combustion engine, electric automobiles also held many speed and distance records. Among the most notable of these records was the breaking of the 100 km per hour speed barrier. This was by Camille Yenatsi. Yes, guys, I said it properly. Don't worry. That's the man's name. So Camille Yannazzi was a Belgian race car driver, and he was also known for breaking the land speed record 3 times and being the first man to break the 100 kilometer per hour barrier. He also had a nickname known as Le Diable Rouge after the color of his beard, which was technically a red beard. But yeah. So Yannazzi on 29 April 1899 in his rocket-shaped vehicle known as Jamais Content was the first road vehicle to go over 100 kilometers per hour. It was a Belgian electric vehicle with a light alloy torpedo-shaped bodywork and batteries. If you guys ever saw the image that I'm looking at right now, it looked weird. You would think it's someone's backyard project being designed and developed. But this is literally how the first signs of, inventions came about. Now, obviously, the particular rocket-shaped electric vehicle of Yannazzi reached 105.88 kilometer per hour speed record. Second onto this was also the notable development that came through from the renowned Ferdinand Porsche, who designed and also made an all-wheel drive electric vehicle. Yes, he made an all-wheel drive electric car powered by a motor in each hub, which also set several records in the hands of its owner, E.W. Hart. The first electric car in the United States was developed in 1890 to 1891 by the Scottish-born William Morrison of Des Moines, Iowa. And this is the funny thing, guys. This vehicle was actually first built for the police department of the city of Des Moines, I don't know how to say this city. You know, I'm trying the best with the basic French I've got. But anyway, it was the first electric vehicle in that city who was made for the police department of that city, Des Moines, in Iowa. The vehicle was a 6-passenger wagon that was capable of reaching a speed of 23 kilometers per hour. It was not until 1895 that consumers began to devote attention to electric vehicles after A.L. Ryker introduced the first electric tricycles to the United States. So, when you're having a look, dealers, at the discussion of electric vehicles and their adoption, there was appetite. It seems there still is appetite. Yes, many of us who have driven internal combustion engines, we would obviously, shake our heads easily by going, nah, you know what, the thing is too silent, I don't hear the engine noise, I don't feel the power, as it's pushing the car forward, I don't hear the moving parts of the engine and all that particular stuff. But there was appetite. There was appetite before the internal combustion engine. The downside is, dear listeners, electricity is a very weird thing to try and sort of like, I almost said liberalize, because that would have made that particularly political from the get-go. And the idea is not to include any politicalization or, politics in the subject matter, because it ultimately does come to a particular talking point, because I even saw another particular development, how politics can even sort of like scrap or impact the best designed, most well designed, most ergonomically manufactured products in the world, which actually mean to achieve what they are supposed to achieve. And just because politics is at play, it gets impacted negatively. So the electric vehicle, dear listeners, is nothing new. In fact, it actually showcased the particular height of human ingenuity, of adoption, of realizing that there are specific requirements. Well, not just requirements, but you could see certain particular positives being designed or being achieved by the use of electric vehicles. I mean, the one specifically was electric locomotives, because an electric locomotive didn't take any oxygen out of the mining facilities that it was deployed at. A very, very good thing to think about, because I did not know that a steam engine or a combustion engine, combustion-powered locomotive would be using some of the necessary air and oxygen in a mining facility that is actually meant for the miners who are down there, you know, chopping away and excavating away in terms of the resource. I didn't realize that something like that comes into play. But then I also realized in many cases, in the earliest forms of mining specifically, that they actually pump air. They pump air into the mining shafts. Air and water. They construct these piping, it looks like pipes in some scenarios. Because they realize the deeper you go, the less air there is in many cases. And obviously there's also the other threat. The deeper you go, sometimes some of these mine shafts, the closer to methane pockets you get. Because remember, a mine shaft doesn't go upwards, it goes downwards into the ground. It never goes up, it goes down. So it obviously makes things pretty precarious for the mining, the mining activity that is being conducted. And it also makes things precarious in the sense of the lives that obviously have to go down there to go and mine. And if you guys don't know how deadly methane is specifically, it's one of the reasons why they always talk about selling the canary in the mine discussion. It's a pretty cruel experiment specifically, but it's an experiment that was always used a lot. Now, highlighting some of the particular discussions in terms of the developments that took place, obviously. The illustrations, meaning the images of photos and drawings that I've got here at my disposal in front of you, you know, it's one of the particular benefits of being the one to see these things first. Sorry, guys. But you have, for example, Gustave Trouvé's tricycle in 1881, which became the world's first electric car, being powered by this particular battery pack. Being highlighted, it was a massive wheel on the left-hand side. A massive wheel, and I really mean it as a massive wheel. It had one seating position, and then two smaller wheels in the front. The one small wheel is on the front, and the other small wheel is at the back. And the battery pack is here, mounted behind the seating position. That's what the tricycle looked like first. The electromote that was developed by Werner von Siemens, the guy that also developed that battery pack itself, was the world's first trolley bus, a four-wheeled particular device that had multiple seats or seating, was obviously open air. It was developed and firstly successfully tested in Berlin of 1882. The third was a Thomas Parker-built electric vehicle. Four equally sized wheels. Thank goodness. Four equally sized wheels. It had its particular, the body situation with the seats on it. At least, being able to carry at least 4 to 5 people on it. And this was in 1895. The Flocken Elektrowagen, which was constructed in 1888. Highlighted the first particular electric vehicle also that had at least a 4-seat arrangement, basic steering capabilities, Also had rudimentary design. Remember, much of these guys were just able to build these open carriage situations, meaning there was no roof on these particular devices, which obviously showed you this was just daytime transportation that they could leverage. Then there was the Columbia Electric, which was an electric cab. If between 1896 to 1899, it was used in Washington, D.C., the capital of the United States. First seen in Pennsylvania Avenue, also a four-wheeler, four-seater mode of transport on a daily use. Obviously, no roof. I don't know why these guys designed these things without roofs, but no roof. Then there was the electric car of 1904. This one was built with a roof, but here's the weird thing. It was a two-seater because the third seat was meant for the driver who sits behind you. So imagine now, imagine you taking a cab or a taxi. But instead of you sitting behind the taxi driver, you're sitting in front of the taxi driver, and the taxi driver is steering the particular vehicle from behind. It sounds weird, ne? Yeah, it does. So the electric car of 1904, with its chauffeur, which sits behind it, which sits behind the passengers that the chauffeur is busy transporting. Compact design with a roof, obviously four-wheel design, and obviously it gets the particular job done. I mean, this thing is probably the size of a modern-day car right now, and you can see how quick this particular, you know, design actually helps things. The world's first police car was the electric wagon used at the Akron Police Department in Des Moines in Iowa, the United States. And this particular vehicle actually had a roof. It actually had a roof, multiple seats, was pretty high for its design, four-wheeler, and it was built and designed in 1899. So this then leads us to the Golden Age. The Golden Age between 1890s to the 1910s, just before the First World War. Now the Golden Age, dear listeners, is crucial in this discussion. Why? Because the Golden Age showed how the developments in and the industries were taking things forward. Things were not standing still. Things were definitely not going to be standing still. And ultimately, how the particular developments obviously flourished from there. When we look at the notable development that obviously came through during this period of the 1890s to the 1910s, was specifically that the interest in the motor vehicles increased greatly in the late 1890s and in the early 1900s. The electric battery-powered taxis became available at the end of the 19th century. In London, a gentleman by the name of Walter Percy designed a fleet of such cabs and introduced them to the streets of London in 1897. They were soon nicknamed the Hummingbirds due to the idiosyncratic humming noise that they made. Obviously, that's obviously what electric things do. If there's a little electric motor, it has a little bit of a humming sound in some cases. In the same year in New York City, Samuel's Electric Carriage and Wagon Company began running 12 electric hansom cabs. Yes, they've used the word hansom. A hansom cab is a kind of a particular carriage designed and patented by a guy by the name of Joseph Hansom. So what happened then? Obviously, they made it electric. Instead of there being a horse in front of it, now there's going to be an electric motor powering it. And yes, this was just a strict and direct conversion job that was done. The company then ran until 1898 with up to 62 cabs operating while it was reformed by its financiers to form the electric vehicle company at that stage, the EVC. The electric vehicle company was an American holding company that also operated up until 1907, and it was an early manufacturer of the battery-powered automobiles. The electric vehicles had then a number of advantages over their early 1900s competitors. Why? They did not have the vibration, smell, and noise associated with gasoline cars. They also did not require gear changes. While steam-powered cars also had no gear shifting, they suffered from long startup times of up to 45 minutes in cold temperatures or in cold mornings. The cars were also preferred because they did not require a manual effort to start, as did gasoline cars, which featured a hand crank to start the engine. It's pretty weird having such particular kind of starting mechanisms that came through. The electric cars also found popularity among well-heeled customers who used them as city cars, where they were limited, where their limited range, meaning the distance that they could cover, proved to be even less of a disadvantage. Now, the acceptance of the electric cars was also initially hampered by a lack of power infrastructure, which is not the thing today. It's just, it's an accessibility component that we have to think about in the modern day context. So, in the US by 1900, 40% of automobiles were powered by steam, 38% were powered by electricity, and 22% were powered by petrol. The United States became the country where electric cars had gained the most acceptance. Most early electric vehicles were massive, ornate carriages designed for the upper-class customers that made them popular. And they also featured luxurious interiors and were replete with pretty expensive materials being put into them. The electric vehicles were often marketed as luxury cars for women, which may have generated a stigma among the male consumers. Maybe. We don't know. We are in 2025. This is 1900 that we're talking about. And sales of electric cars also peaked in the early 1910s. There were over 300 listed manufacturers who produced a vehicle in the US until 1942. So, in the 1910s, the Standard Electric used Westinghouse electric motors and claimed to have a range of 110 miles on a charge. It was operated by a tiller from the left-hand side. The controller had 6 forward speeds and a top speed of 20 miles per hour. The Model M was a closed model coupe and an open runabout and priced between $1,700 to $1,900 at the time. The Beardsley Electric Company, founded in Los Angeles by a gentleman by the name of Volney Beardsley in 1913, produced 661 electric vehicles between 1914 and 1917. A typical cruising range was 115 kilometers. One model, known as the Light Town Car, in 1916 was priced at $1,200, which was equivalent in 2025 to $37,000, obviously included all the inflations that have taken place up to date. So as you can see, dear listeners, the discussion about the electric vehicle has been one that has always been there. There's never been a discussion of something that only popped up now in the 20 teens, for that matter. But before we continue, we quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners, and we come back right after that, heading into the last quarter of this morning session of my Sunday Morning Take.
Bargain Hunters, you save has slashed prices on groceries, treats, fresh fruit, and veggies. 2 kilos real good frozen mixed chicken portions, just $89.99. 5 kilos champion super maize meal, just $56.99. And pay just $19.99 for each of the following. 700 milliliter crystal gold tomato sauce, 1 liter clover full cream milk, and 200 grams of champion hunters poloni. Save big at You Save.
Do you ever wonder why we have so many road rules? Like, don't jaywalk, don't drink and drive, don't drive with underinflated tires, and don't speed. It's because we don't want you to put your life at risk. Don't become a statistic. Don't become a headline. Be a responsible road user. Do the right thing and save lives.
This message was brought to you by the National Road Safety Council.
All I've never finished. your stones in times, way hard on this mind. Pushing on doors that won't open. I've drowned out any meditation. I'll breathe until the air ran out. It's just this mixed up mind, wasting time. What if my decisions end out with a mind full of madness and a heart full of sadness? I'll go wherever you lead. With a head full of misses, all I've never finished, that person I'll never be. With a mind full of madness and a heart full of sadness, I'll go wherever you lead. With a head full of misses, all I've congratulations, or to hear the crowd applaud. It's just this reckless mind, wasting time, lost every time that I fought. With a mind
to me. If you really feel that you need some time to be free, time to go out searching for yourself, hoping to find time to go to find. It don't matter to me if you take up with someone who's better than me, 'cause your happiness is all I want for you to find. Your peace of mind. A lot of people have an ego hang-up 'cause they wanna be the only one. How many came before? It really doesn't matter, just as long as you're the best. Everybody moving on and trying to find out what's been missing in the past. And it don't matter to me if your searching brings you back together with me, 'cause there'll always be an empty room waiting for you, an open heart waiting for you. On my side, 'cause it don't matter to me. 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 Be an empty room
'cause it don't matter to me.
Now coming back there from the sounds of Bread. Before that, you heard a little bit of sounds of the group Take That with Mindful of Madness. And before that, it was a song just for tonight, ultimately from the electric duo known as Groove Armada, bringing you that particular insight right taking place right there. Now, obviously, the developments of the electric vehicle had been booming up until the 19-teens, you know, moving well into the range in terms of being something that could be adopted widely, could achieve the commercial viability, which it in many cases already did. And obviously becoming the particular sort of like, if we can call it like the beacon of hope for public transport at a broader scenario. However, power is always at the heart of this discussion. And I'm not talking about power in the sense of who makes a decision of what, where. No, I'm talking about power as the powertrain, the thing giving the device the power. Now, to overcome the limited operating range of electric vehicles and the lack of recharging infrastructure, an exchangeable battery service was first proposed in as early as 1896. The concept was first put into practice by the Hartford Electric Light Company through the GVCo battery service and was initially available for electric trucks. The vehicle owner purchased the vehicle from the General Vehicle Company, GVC, which was a subsidiary of General Electric Company, without a battery, and the electricity was purchased from the Hartford Electric through an exchangeable battery. The owner paid a variable charge and a monthly service fee to cover the maintenance and the storage of the truck. Both vehicle and batteries were modified to facilitate a fast battery exchange. The service was provided between 1910 and 1924, and during that period covered more than 6 million miles. A lot. It's probably 12 million kilometers, perhaps. Beginning in 1917, a similar successful service was operated in Chicago for owners of Milbourne Wagon Company cars who also could buy the vehicle without the batteries. In New York City, in the pre-World War I era, 10 electric vehicle companies banded together to form the New York Electric Vehicle Association. This association included manufacturers and dealers, among them General Motors' truck division and the aforementioned General Vehicle Division of General Electric, which claimed to have almost 2,000 operating vehicles in the metropolitan region alone. Now, when opening up their flagship department store, the business by the name of Lord & Taylor boasted of its electric vehicle fleet, numbering at least 38 trucks, and the conveyor system to efficiently load and unload goods. Thomas Edison himself also, you know, highlights some of the particular developments that took place in the electric vehicle development, because Edison is in this one fifth photo standing next to a electric vehicle. The Detroit Electric advertisement that obviously also showed the particular prototype that they had running. And you had the 1914 Beardsley electric car on display specifically, also highlighting some of the particular developments in shape, design, and size that actually came about. Then came the dark ages for the electric cars. And yes, it started becoming pretty dark. So from the 1920s to the 1950s, this particular period obviously showcased the doldrums of what actually happened. Because after enjoying the success of the 20th century, or at the start of the 20th century, the electric car began to lose its position in the automobile market. This is as a number of developments contributed to the situation. By the 1920s, an improved road infrastructure had improved travel times, creating a need for vehicles with greater range than that was offered by electric cars. Worldwide discoveries of large petroleum reserves led to the wide availability of affordable petrol, making petrol-powered cars cheaper to operate over long distances. Electric cars were limited to urban use by their slow speeds, because they could only reach, in many cases, up to 32 kilometers per hour, and their low ranges, meaning they could at most only achieve 65 kilometers in terms of distance. And the gasoline vehicles were now able to drive farther and faster with equivalent than the equivalent electrics at the time. Gasoline cars also overcame much of their negatives compared to electrics in several areas. For example, these cars could originally, had to, the gasoline cars first, if you guys ever knew what that hand cranking was, and the first petrol or gasoline powered cars or internal combustion engine cars had a thing at the front of the car. Now, instead of you, like what you do today is you get into your car, put your key in the ignition or into the starter, and you just turn the key. These first internal combustion engines, literally the way you had to start them was you had to put, it looks like a shaft of some kind. Yeah, it's a crankshaft technically, but you had to put the shaft in the front of the car and you had to crank the engine, meaning you had to literally, it was like a, what was that thing we had with the old Golfs? It was like the jump start. It was like jump starting the car. You had to jump start the car with, you know, your physical human power. You crank it once, crank it twice, crank it a third time, and then the car starts. That was the downside of the first internal combustion engine cars. But by the 1920s, the technology had improved. They had taken away that stupid cranking situation that, you know, many people would bothered with or bogged down with in the earliest format. And now you could just start the car up and you could drive. That hand cranking had been taken away, which was a difficult and sometimes also a dangerous activity. Yes, because people actually got killed in some instances when the cranking was done. The invention of the electric starter by Charles Kettering in 1912 eliminated the need of a hand starting crank. Further on, while gasoline engines were inherently noisier than electric motors, the invention of the muffler by Milton Reeves and Marshall Reeves in 1897 significantly reduced the noise to tolerable levels. Lastly, the initiation of mass production of gas-powered vehicles by Henry Ford, gas-powered obviously meaning gasoline-powered vehicles by Henry Ford, brought their price down. By contrast, the price of similar electric vehicles continued to rise, because by 1912, an electric vehicle sold for almost double the price of a gasoline car. Most electric car makers stopped production at some point in the 1910s. Electric vehicles became popular for certain applications where their limited range did not pose major problems. Forklift trucks were electrically powered when they were introduced by Yale in 1923. In Europe, especially the UK, milk floats were powered by electricity, and for most of the 20th century, the majority of the world's battery electric road vehicles were British milk floats. Electric golf carts were produced by Electro as early as 1955. By the 1920s, the early heyday of electric cars had passed, and a decade later, the 1930s, the electric automobile industry had effectively disappeared. Now, this obviously meant that there was a lull. You know, there was nothing going on for close to 60, 70 years. Years passed without a major revival in the use of electric cars. Fuel-starved European countries fighting in World War II experimented with electric cars such as the British milk floats and the French Breguet aviation car. Now, the Breguet aviation car, it was literally an egg was, it was actually a kind of a invention that came through from a French aircraft manufacturer. But overall, the internal combustion engine development progressed at very fast paces. Electric vehicle technology continued to stagnate. In the late 1950s, Henny Coachworks and the National Union Electric Company, makers of Exide batteries, formed a joint venture to produce a new electric car, the Henny Kilowatt, based on the French Renault Dauphin. Now, the Henny Kilowatt was an electric car that was introduced in the US as a 1959 model car. The car used some parts of this French Renault Dauphin, or Dauphin, as the word is actually supposed to be. And it was an improved model, was introduced in 1960 with a top speed of at least 60 miles, which is 120 kilometers an hour, and a range of only 60 miles, i.e. 120 kilometers as well. There were only 47 of them ever made. Now, the car was produced in a 36 volt to 72 volt configurations. The 72 volt models had a top speed approaching 96 kilometers per hour and could travel for nearly an hour on a single charge. Despite the kilowatt's improved performance with respect to previous electric cars, it was about double the cost of a regular gasoline-powered Dauphin, and production ended in 1961. There was a 1947 model also produced by the Japanese, known as the Tachikawa Aircraft Company, produced the Mechanical Engineering Heritage No. 40 model, or they call it the electric vehicle Tama in Japan. Pretty compact, pretty small, straight to the point, decent design. You know, not like the earlier designs that I described to you guys of sometimes not having a roof, big wheels, looking uncomfortable, only being a two-seater for its size in many cases. In Germany in 1953, the German post office company, Deutsche Post, tried making use of, and this was in East Germany, tried making use of East German electric vans. Obviously, as you can see, just delivering post, which is a short, range discussion, meaning you could charge it. It had its use in short range discussions. Obviously, it comes down with cost scenarios, because petrol was a scenario of you have to refill the engine every time. But this was just about recharging a battery, and then you just deliver and you come back. Interest then once again popped up in the 1960s to the 1990s. Revival of interest. Now, obviously, as I said, you know, things went quiet for like 70 years. Even though you have this revival interest discussion popping up again. But things were still going quiet. So, in 1959, the American Motors Corporation and a Sonatone Corporation announced a joint research effort to consider producing an electric car powered by a self-charging battery, which is wonderful if the battery can recharge itself. Reason being, you increase range and you increase potentially speed. So AMC had a reputation for innovation in economical cars, while Sonatone had technology for making sintered plate nickel-cadmium batteries that could be recharged rapidly and weighed less than traditional lead-acid batteries. That same year, New Way Industries showed an experimental electric car with a one-piece plastic body that was to begin production in early 1960. In the mid-1960s, a few battery electric concept cars appeared, such as the Scottish Aviation Scamp, which was produced in 1965. Pretty small, pretty cramped. I don't want to say pretty ugly as well, but you know what? We keep our particular tastes separate. And an electric version of the General Motors gasoline car, the Electro-Vair of 1966, pretty big, pretty stylish, pretty nice, you know, pretty contemporary. It was known as the Chevrolet Corvette. That was the electric version of the same car that was produced by General Motors. None of these particular concepts entered into production. The 1973 Enfield 8000, also pretty small, pretty cramped, small wheels, not as, technically not ugly-ish, did make it into small-scale production. Remember the 1973 Enfield 8000. 112 were eventually produced in 1967. AMC then partnered up with Galton Industries to develop a new battery based on lithium and a speed controller designed by Victor Vogt. Now, a nickel cadmium battery supplied power to an electric, to an all-electric 1969 Rambler American station wagon. Also contemporary vehicle design, pretty big, pretty contemporary, well designed, obviously. And this obviously gave, you know, it would easily appeal to the customer of the day. Other plug-in experimental AMC vehicles developed with Galton included the Amatron of 1967. I don't know why these guys always come up with ugly designs for electric cars, but yeah. Two-seater, very compact, not nice to look at. You can't carry much besides yourself and the person sitting next to you, and that's about it. But they obviously try to make it as economical as possible. The other particular production that they also developed was the Electron of 1977, similar to the Amatron of 1967. The one was 1977, the one was 1967, and they both looked the same. On 31 July of 1971, an electric car received the unique distinction of becoming the first crewed vehicle to drive on the moon. Now that should actually help you try and understand what is going on here. Because if we can have an electric car drive on the moon, but not try to adopt the technology locally here on Earth, you know, as wide range as possible, obviously it should indicate to you that, you know, we've got some certain particular factors to deal with. Now that car, which became the first crewed vehicle to drive on the moon, was the Lunar Roving Vehicle. Two-seater, big wheels, not much going on there, and that was it. Which was first deployed during the Apollo 15 mission. The moon buggy was developed by Boeing and the General Motors subsidiary Delco Electronics. Featured a DC drive motor on each wheel and a pair of 36 volt silver zinc potassium hydroxide non-rechargeable batteries. After years outside the limelight, the energy crises of the 1970s and the 1980s brought about renewed interest in the perceived independence electric cars had from the fluctuations of the hydrocarbon energy market. However, vehicles such as the intensely marketed Sinclair C5 failed. I don't know why they tried selling something like this to anyone. The Sinclair C5, guys, was technically a tricycle with one seat. That's it. A tricycle with one seat. General Motors created a concept car using another gasoline car as the base, the Electro Vet of 1976. Very stylish, pretty contemporary, obviously there to play into the current consumer demand. At the 1990 Los Angeles Auto Show, General Motors President Roger Smith unveiled the GM Impact electric concept car, also contemporary, also stylish, playing into the current demands of consumer needs, along with an announcement that General Motors would build electric vehicles for sale to the public at that particular stage in 1990. Now, from the 1960s to the 1990s, a number of companies made electric vehicles, but before we continue, dear listeners, we'll take a short ad break.
Esira shisho, pagyo tadi ku kwathere opogoro kara uasira ya kweni ochisho. Watu chithana basic mental health first aid course. Haiganjua oshari chamhongi kwa mboka iri iyo iyo NHP. Watapewa unongo nonseo na kene una okutongorora omadidiriko ugopetameko ugena sha nupiakadhi nenge omathidakano gopama viraviro kuchane omokatiko kumekoe nenge anirongo kupanga pamwe nangoe osho otopewa unongo nkene una okuya kwathera nokuya pa eabidhidho yili mwonjira omanga upya kadiboka inauru darara kuyerere ounji na nkene unokara uishangitha tarirapo epanja yao yo nhp.com.na epango na maradura sano odovina okurandurwa NHP rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Now, that ultimately does not bring us up to the end as yet, because there's a whole bunch of developments that also took place specifically in this EV landscape. Now, as developers obviously being outlined in the 1960s to the 1990s, a number of these companies tried making battery electric vehicles converted from existing manufactured models. And they were often also using gliders. None were solid in large numbers, with sales obviously hampered by high costs and limited ranges. So the biggest challenge was trying to discover or develop how the car can actually move further at a less or at a better economical rate. Not trying to increase the burden of costs to the consumer, but rather trying to achieve a balance between cost and functionality. Most of these vehicles were sold to government agencies and electric utility companies. The passage of the Electric and Hybrid Vehicle Research, Development and Demonstration Act of 1976 in the US provided government incentives for development of electric vehicles in the US. Electric Fuel Propulsion Corporation, now known as Apollo Energy Systems, produced the Electro Sport, which was a converted AMC Hornet. The Mars 1, which was a converted Renault Dauphin, and the Mars 2, which was a converted Renault R10, all of them functional. Jet Industries sold the Electra Van 600, which was a converted Subaru Sambar 600. The Electra Van 750, which was a converted Mazda B2000, or a Ford Courier pickup truck. The Electrica, which was a converted Ford Escort, or a Mercury Lynx car, in that scenario. And the Electrica 007, which was a converted Omni 024, or a Plymouth Horizon car. You also had the U.S. Electric Car Corporation, based in Massachusetts, that sold the Electric Leopard, a converted Renault 5, for that matter, and the Electric Vehicle Associates, that sold the current Fair, which was a converted Ford Fairmont at that stage. And you also had the Change of Pace, which was a converted AMC Pacer. Now, in all of these particular things, you could see that the electric car companies were experimenting, trying. They were using a contemporary body of a car that was out in the market, and then obviously trying to adopt a electric motor into the power system of the car. And this was going on because all of these car designs were technically into the 90s, from the 1960s into the 90s. Because in the early 1990s, the California Air Resources Board, which was the government of California's clean air agency, began a push for more fuel efficient, low emission vehicles, with the ultimate goal of making a move to zero emissions vehicles such as electric vehicles. In response, automakers began developing electric vehicles, which included the Chrysler T-Van, the Ford Ranger EV, the GM EV1, the S10 EV, which is also a bucky, technically just with an electric motor, the Honda EV Plus, a compact hatchback, the Nissan lithium battery Ultra EV mini wagon, yes, an SUV, multi-seat, all that, and the Toyota RAV4 EV at the particular time. Now, what this actually also meant was that the California government obviously developed legislation that would provide incentives. Now, you guys heard of the incentives that I spoke about at the start of the discussion. That in the American market, there's an incentive for people that they enjoy on their tax. You know, you get a tax break specifically if you buy an electric vehicle, and then it's a tax credit that gets applied to your taxes. Now, the Altra was notable for being the first production EV specifically to use lithium-ion batteries, which is now the predominant technology being pursued. The automakers were accused of pandering to the wishes of the California Air Resources Board in order to continue to be allowed to sell cars in the lucrative California market, while failing to adequately promote the electric vehicles in order to create the impression that the consumers were not interested in the cars. All the while, joining oil industry lobbyists in vigorously protesting the California Air Resources Board's mandate. Now, General Motors' program came under particular scrutiny in an unusual move, as consumers were not allowed to purchase EV1s, but were instead asked to sign closed-end leases, meaning that the cars had to be returned to GM at the end of the lease period, with no option to purchase, despite lease interests in continuing to own the cars. Chrysler, Toyota, and a group of GM dealers sued the California Air Resources Board in a federal court. So you can obviously see some of the particular negative developments that also popped up. After public interest, public protests by electric vehicle drivers groups upset by the repossession of their cars, Toyota then offered the last 328 RAV4 EVs for sale to the general public for 6 months until November of 2002. Almost all other production electric cars were withdrawn from the market and were in some cases seen to have been destroyed by their manufacturers. Toyota continues to support the several hundred Toyota RAV4 EVs in the hands of the general public and in a fleet usage scenario. GM famously deactivated the few EV1s that were donated to engineering schools and museums. Now that does bring us up to the end of our discussion for this morning, dear listeners. Specifically, as it also brings us up to the end of our discussion here on my Sunday morning take. We'll be taking a short musical break and coming back right after that, heading into our goodbye that we have to say in that scenario. On that note, we'll be back right after this short break.